You're listening to Save My City, part of the We Love Where You Live podcast series brought to you by the Michigan Municipal League. Here's your host, Tony Mangini.
Hey, thanks for joining us on our latest podcast. I'm thrilled today to be joined by Anna Clark. Anna Clark is an author who wrote The Poison City, which is a book about Flint and the water system failures and all of the things that went on around that. So I really appreciate you for joining us today.
Oh, this is wonderful. Thank you so much for having me.
So Anna, I had the pleasure of meeting back early before she wrote the book. And we actually had lunch and talked about all the different things that were going on. And at the time, it was a very fresh wound. It was very active at that time. And you started putting this book together. And we talked about, in addition to all the things that everyone read about every day, we started talking about the tie backs to sort of the fundamentals of the system and how that played into what happened in Flint. So definitely want to talk about some of that kind of stuff. But why don't you just talk to us a little bit about, you know, your experience of writing the book and sort of what even brought you to write this book?
So many things. Well, I'm a journalist in Detroit. I write about a number of different things for a number of different publications. But what I've kept coming back to over the years is writing about cities. You know, I'm really interested in how places are made, how they're unmade, how different kinds of policies affect people's lives, really inventive visions that people have for doing things better than we have in the past. And, you know, being in Detroit, of course, it's very rich ground for a lot of these stories. And also I've had a chance to go to other places too. It's something I found very compelling. I especially felt like I could make a contribution by, you know, writing about and from cities that are very underchronicled and very disinvested, because I feel like they're not understood well. And a lot of our civic values are put to a test in the most extreme ways in these situations. So reckoning with it seemed very important.
You know, you used a phrase, I've never heard it before, but I'm going to steal it, just heads up. And you talk about how cities are unmade.
Yes.
And in my mind, and I think, you know, the book bears this out, what happened in Flint and what's happened in other places as well, just without the drama of the incredible human impacts of their water system failures, is these places were unmade. It was very sort of systematic in a series of dozens of events, not a single thing that everyone's keying in on here, but rather a history of actions or inactions that really manifested themselves.
Right. And it's like, and I think it seems inevitable or invisible in a lot of ways when it plays out over such long periods of times, just years and years, decades and decades. But it's not, you know, there are choices. And in fact, neglect itself is a choice, you know, that has consequences. And so when things were happening in Flint, I began, you know, writing articles about it, though with the caveat that I, like many people, was way too late. I felt like I should have been there much sooner, because this is the kind of stuff I write about. And I felt like I should have been there sooner. But I did start doing some articles about it. And those articles led someone to reach out to me about doing a book. And I had some questions and cautions about that at first, but ultimately it looked like a really great opportunity to bring in some of this history that I felt was so important to what was playing out with the water crisis. But even in longer articles, you just don't have the scope to get into it. So that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to not just bring some clarity to the story of the water crisis itself, which, you know, is complex and wild and is still playing out in many ways, but also bring forth the history and the context within Flint, within Michigan, and nationally that that sets places up to fail. And also put the question forth, like, about why we don't really feel uncomfortable about that until something as dramatic as a citywide water poisoning happens.
It is amazing that it comes to that. It's also interesting when you read this and you read again, this isn't just in the last, you know, that 18-month period, but this longer horizon of that. And I think you use the term inevitable at some point. And it was,
yeah.
I mean, when you look at what was happening, this was inevitable. And it almost feels like if someone would have pushed themselves back from the table and looked at this in a broader way, someone would have said, we got trouble coming, but they didn't. And it wasn't realized that the case, one of the things, and this is a silly thing to take away, but You talked about the size of the interceptors that were sized for the full on of GM and 200,000 people, and how now we have, you know, third or less of GM and half the population. And I sort of have this visual in my mind of the water trying to, you know, fill this massive, you know, pipe. And obviously that's not going to work. And in a lot of ways, the science of that mm-hmm. all ties in together. It's just kind of crazy to think about.
Yeah. The infrastructure, really romances me. So nerd alert, but it does. I mean, it's
major nerd, right?
but it's such a powerful image as you're describing. Like, right, there's this, you know, a lot of times when we visualize struggling, disinvested cities, we picture vacancy, right? We picture these like vacant lots and vacant houses and commercial strips. But it's interesting to think about what it looks like underground. You know, where the pipes are literally tracing out the shape of the community, not just as it was, but as it hoped to be. I mean, the reason Flint got on Detroit's water system in the first place in the 60s is because they had been growing so rapidly for so long and thought that the pattern was going to continue and that they needed a stronger water capacity. So these pipes were built to serve not only a city twice its current size, but also one that had a huge industrial sector with GM using up to like 60% of the water supply. Wow. And they anticipated growing. So it was even larger for that. And of course, when people and businesses and industry exited the city over the years, the pipes don't shrink proportionally, right? So this isn't just a problem that Flint is dealing with, but shrinking cities all over the country. You know, like you have fewer and poorer people who are shouldering the burden of maintaining this like gigantic infrastructure system, which can't work. It just doesn't work. It doesn't work. It's an emergency before we even get to the problems of treatment.
Yeah. We could go in 50 mm-hmm. directions with this, right? But that's one of the problems of sprawl is mm-hmm. you build this infrastructure. As you point out, it's there. You built it for a purpose. You basically essentially abandoned that infrastructure, and then it can't sustain itself. It can't sustain itself in how it operates, and it can't sustain itself fiscally. And then it gets boiled down to, at some point, people making bad decisions. But yeah. as you point out, if you look in the longer horizon of how and why these things happen, there was an expectation at the time that any of us would have came to that I need to have this infrastructure in place to support this development, this population, which why would I think it would not continue? And that reality changed because we incented that. I mean, that's one of the things that I know when I talk about this in a broader context outside of Flint, you know, we're getting exactly what we're trying to incent here. And so we've doubled our infrastructure. We've done all these things, not adding people. And we're wondering why it's collapsing us under its own weight. And you know, Flint illustrates every one of these points in vivid color, tragically so, but it's amazing. And you see the impact of these decisions. And, you know, they were sort of allowed to happen without regard to any of the consequences of doing that, because there wasn't sort of that holistic view of some of this stuff. And I think at some point we've got to get back to how do you think about this as a state or at least as a region, and not this city versus that city versus the next city.
Right. And that's another reason that infrastructure is so interesting. It's like, you know, a lot of the suburbs had the opportunity to grow because they hooked onto the city system, you know, like the city effectively, looking backwards, was subsidizing its own disinvestment. And that was with Truth Flint. That was Truth Detroit. That's true. And so on. But what if we did look at things differently? What if we, you know, like it is despairing as so much of this story is, with so many people making so many choices with negative consequences over decades, and sometimes in the most baffling of circumstances. The one thing that really does give me hope and excites me is like how that kind of underscores the power of what could happen if we make better choices, right? Like our ability to make choices is really like the places we choose to invest in, the places we choose, how we choose to cooperate, how we choose to like reimagine our urban structures so that it is not still playing out this sort of so-called separate but equal mm-hmm. dynamic, but in fact really like bringing folks together so that we can all thrive. Like that's That's powerful. You know, it really is powerful. And I think this is, you know, we were just talking before that we this recorded about changes in Detroit over the last few years. I think too a lot about how much of that is, you know, attributed to how folks just a lot of folks with power decided that they were going to care about it now. You know,
I think it's well said. I mean, I think, you know, Detroit was certainly unique. Fact set. And in some ways, I always worry sometimes that Detroit was too easy, you know, and not that Lord knows there's a long way to go here, but because everyone came together, as you said, all of the powers aligned and said, we're going to fix this and we're going to change the future. But the reality is we still didn't fix the structure of how we operate government here in Michigan. So yeah. I think, you know, this has all got to tie back to a way of operating and a way of envisioning this state that works for everyone. And it doesn't right now. We still have a system that, you know, Flint could theoretically happen again tomorrow. I mean, if we're being honest about it, we changed our lead, you know, standard or whatever. I thought that was kind of a meaningless, you know, thing to do because it didn't fix the structure of why that happened. So all of the same fact sets that allowed Flint to happen could happen again.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there have been some policy changes regarding like, you know, infrastructure and water and all that. And I think they're great, but you're right. I mean, it's applying a solely technical solution to this problem. And there are some technical problems. So we can make some progress there. That's great. But yeah, I mean, of course, this is like the underlying problem of concentrating our poverty and therefore concentrating our vulnerability and having that parallel almost exactly race or race segregation is continues to this day. There's transparency records or transparency laws or lack of transparency laws are still an issue. The emergency manager law has been unmodified despite a number of bipartisan people thinking that at minimum it needs reform. There's a lot of the like larger contextual issues that set up the Flint water crisis are continuing on, right? And the idea that it could happen again, like it is, you know, like there's like Benton Harbor is like dealing with a huge like a lot of lead and water issues right now. There's it's not a coincidence. Detroit Public Schools like turned off its water at the beginning of the school year because of like high lead, you know, contents. It is happening again. And this is why we know it's not just a couple of people who just didn't do their jobs well. It is a pattern. It is a pattern that's playing out again and again and again.
Yeah. And when you have this constriction of population, but not a corresponding constriction of the infrastructure, of course, the cost to operate it goes exponentially. And when you said Benton Harbor, it reminded me of a I had a meeting there several years ago with the council, and they were coming out of emergency management, and I was doing some training and things with them. And one of the things they were struggling with was, from a fiscal management perspective, rates should be set at X, right? In some respects, setting rates is very simple. My cost is, you know, X, my flow is right. Y, the result is Z, bang, here we go. But the problem is no one can afford Z.
Yeah.
And so what do you do with that? And I had to look back across the dais and say, I wish I knew, but I don't have an answer to that. I'm only here for this part of the conversation. And I couldn't imagine sitting in your chair trying to parse that out, because obviously people need to have water for healthy living for a variety of reasons. And yet you can't afford it and you can't not charge them.
Yeah. The utility, you can't. I mean, this is like the problem of like concentrating vulnerability and poverty. Like theoretically, you know, like the utility, I mean, there's good reasons for a lot of these policies that set rates for utilities, right? But they're sort of based on the idea that the population it serves has a mix of incomes, you know, and most people can afford it. And those who can't, you know, might be sort of subsidized, you know, with like, you know, some assistance programs that are partly supported by those who can pay that. I mean, and that's theoretically how it's able to maintain itself. But when you have like, such a disproportionately impoverished population, you know, that it's not just a counter argument. It's just a fact. Like people literally cannot afford it. And this is, you know, in Flint, you know, before the water crisis, like they literally had some of the most expensive water rates in the entire country, which is wild when you think about like how that, what a mismatch that is with this like abundance of water we live among. But they were, and it was an unaffordability crisis before it became a water quality crisis, you know, because people couldn't pay it, so weren't paying it, so had their water shut off, which was becoming a public health problem because it was affecting so many people. There's water theft prosecutions for people who had illegal hookups, which were very controversial. There was, when you rented a place, in addition to paying a security deposit, you would have to pay a water deposit, which just made your initial move-in costs just preposterous for people. It was a cycling problem, one that is entirely predictable given the context we have here. And I think if we're imagining how to do things better, we have to start, you know, imagining solutions that go beyond the city borders. Like, it's not just a Flint problem. It's not just a Benton Harbor problem. How can we all feel like we have a stake in making sure that all residents of this, of the Great Lakes state, has access to safe, affordable water?
You know, and as we sit here and we talk about it, and I, this isn't something that if people, anyone saw me speak, has heard me say this, you know, many times. This idea that we've literally doubled our infrastructure in the last 20 plus years and haven't had any people. Right. So that math problem doesn't work. You don't have to be great with numbers to realize that that doesn't work. But I hadn't thought about it in this context until you were just commenting about, you know, concentrations of poverty and things like that. Again, our policies are creating it very systematically. Yeah. I don't think that was the intentional outcome. Right. But if I continue to expand that infrastructure and people leave a place that's struggling for a place that's not, I continue to create new places that struggle. And in doing so, this investment on, you know, the left side of the equation is to the detriment of the right. And so, you know, the net effect is probably worse than had we done that. I mean, let's just say we didn't build any new infrastructure the last 20 years. All those places that are struggling, people would still be living there to be vibrant places that still kind of worked. And so we were having a conversation earlier in a meeting earlier talking about, you know, is Michigan prepared for an influx of people? And I jokingly said, but it wasn't really joking, that, well, shouldn't be a problem. We've already built all the infrastructure. Like, come on back, you know? And the question I think is, how do you have those strategies that truly are supportive of the whole state? You know, and, you know, we talk a lot about placemaking and things like that. And that requires people to work.
Yeah.
And so I just think we got to have a different, you know, broader approach, smarter approach in how we do this stuff.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I hope for. Of course, you know, and as not just as a, you know, a journalist, but like a stakeholder, right? Like I choose to be in this place. I want to be in this state, you know, there's so much I love about it and about the people here. But it frustrates me when we like sort of stunt our own potential by making, short-sighted, decisions. Mm-hmm. And ones that really, you know, effectively like see each other as like opponents as opposed to partners. Because I think that if we let ourselves, like, we can really like create something, you know, that's truly like a model for the rest of the country, not a warning story for the rest of the country, but a model, you know, and one that has, you know, thriving places of all different kinds of sizes and characters, and one where we handle our water beautifully in a way that supports, you know, people's quality of life and recreation and health and our economy. I mean, like we have a lot of potential here. But to unleash it, we really do have to like reckon with the past. Like, we can't just pretend it didn't happen. I think that's not worked for us so far. I mean, would that so many of these bad decisions weren't made, but they were. And here are the consequences. So we got to deal with that, like on an emotional level as well as a technical level, you know, just because people are carrying this, the baggage of the past with them. It's informing every decision they make or don't make. And I feel like we really got to like face that fearlessly if we are going to be able to move forward.
I completely agree with that. I think I always come back to, you know, Detroit has, I don't know, 100 customers, some big, huge number like that. And all of them were facing the same rate pressures. Only one of them chose to leave, right? Because they were forced into a situation where they couldn't consider those broader impacts that you just described. It was all a money transaction, and they sort of ignored any fact that wasn't supportive of moving forward, or weren't given an opportunity to consider some of those. And a bad decision got made, you know, and how do you get to look at that in a different way that makes sense in this broader context? And that is going to be, I think that marriage of the emotion and the intellect is kind of where that's going to lie somewhere. And I don't have a magic answer to how we do that, but that's a place I think we've got to strive to get to. Otherwise, we've not changed the structure, again, I'm being redundant somewhat, of what happened in Flint. So we raced into Flint, we've replaced a bunch of lines or whatever, and let's just say that Flint is quote unquote, you know, fixed. And I'm not sure that's an accurate statement. Let's just pretend for right now that it is. The structure of what caused it still remains. And so it's just a question of when is the next one, how we do it, and how we do that. And it's a marriage of, as well, the technical delivery of water and sewer and all the things that environmentally and health-wise matter to us, and the fiscal responsibility of those things. And how do you blend those together? And again, I think this is going to require a rethink of how we do some of that stuff. And I'm just hoping we're getting to a place now where we can have conversations at that level to do that. Because as long as we're allowed to do these things individually and only consider how it affects me immediately, I think it's ripe to happen again.
It is. I mean, we do need that long-term vision. And I think, one thing that your organization talks a lot about is, like, you know, revenue sharing, for example. And it's not lost on people in Flint that had they had over the years that amount of money that otherwise would have come to it that has since, like, kind of stagnated, they very likely wouldn't have gone into emergency management, which means they very likely would not have had this cascade of problems that resulted from using the Flint River as a short-term water solution. And I think that's worth reckoning with as well. That's another part of, like, the sort of unfixed context of this story is how a decision like withheld revenue sharing is affecting every community in Michigan, but because some places are so much closer to the edge, it can be enough to push people into like a true catastrophe, especially when it overlaps with the recession and the housing crisis and other things. I mean, like, what do you expect from people? Like, it's not like, I think we do sometimes get in a tangle when we start imagining problems as only being the result of poor local, poor local decisions. This idea of, like, you not knowing what the exact solution is, I don't either. But, like, one thing we can remind ourselves is that no one person does or should have all the wisdom or power for figuring out what to do. We really do need the wisdom of the collective to move forward. I mean, that's. And, you know, that's theoretically what democracy is all about. Mm-hmm. So we can do that.
A couple of things. I pretty much put food in the table talking about revenue sharing. So I'm all in on that. But, you know, I'm sitting here thinking about it. And if Flint had the choice between getting all the revenue sharing back or having 200,000 people live there, they should flush that revenue sharing down the toilet. Mm. No pun intended, by the way.
That's actually an interesting option. That'd be an interesting choice.
You know, and that's where I think we've sort of lost our way is all this development, which is great, and places that are thriving because of it have a cost. And we've got to figure out, I think, how we balance that as well as how we invest those dollars. That's the other part, too, that I think the state missed when they made those decisions to intercept that revenue sharing, not just from Flint, from communities all over the state, is they didn't understand. And I would argue maybe still don't completely understand what the long-term impacts of that and the opportunity cost that's costing us. Mm-hmm. Because if us not having great communities is standing in the way of people coming back, and I would suggest that's a huge part of it, then the long-term cost of that was way too great for that short, by avoiding that impact it might have had in the budget, or, you know, God forbid we raised, you know, taxes a nickel or something, to balance this stuff out better, I think would have paid far greater dividends. We had a whole different Michigan right now.
Right. You're saying like not just had communities had this money, they not just could have, it's they not only could have paid for like X, Y, and Z, but also X, Y, and Z would have generated more college graduates that chose to stay here, exactly. for example.
So, mm-hmm. so give us some context. If we'd have kept pace since 1980, population-wise, rest of the country, there'd be 14 million people living in Michigan. So that's a different place, right? That's
it's,
a whole
it's hard for me to imagine. It actually place. Is hard for me to
just,
imagine.
If we just kept pace.
I was just reading about how we're probably going to lose another congressional representative.
Yeah. Oh, it's done. That's done deal, yeah. right? So, I mean, when you think about it, that's another 4 million people living here just to be keeping pace with the rest of the state. In terms of influence, income, all those different things yeah. in Michigan, it's a different place. And the other thing that's lost when, you know, when Flint, somebody loses 100,000 people, housing stock. I mean, forget just the maintenance infrastructure, safety, all these things that happen because a community is strong and vibrant mm-hmm. that are there and inherently there, and the diversity of everyone living there. It's a whole different place. And I think we've got to twist this thing, you know, 45 degrees and get back to thinking about things that way and recognizing the strength and having if all places, you know, all ships kind of rising is, mm-hmm. is what we got to get back to. And revenue sharing was an attempt at that and in doing that. But that you overlay that with development practices and whatnot. I mean, it can be done. We've just got to be smarter about what we're doing.
And we can be like the policies that effectively hollowed out so many communities were incredibly effective. And what so you can imagine what would happen if we, reverse them, you know, what if we did that? What if we decided just as intentionally that we're going to kind of, build like strong core cities that where the whole full metropolitan area is able to benefit from it, as opposed to feel like, you know, there can be only one survivor.
Yep. So I know we're getting kind of long. I feel like you and I could go all afternoon talking about this. Single most shocking thing you found in the book. What comes to mind?
That is genuinely a hard thing to answer. I feel like I did spend the entire book writing experience just sort of turning to whoever is next to me and being like, can you believe? I'm still not entirely over my shock that something like this happened. But one thing that I'll elevate, one of the things that's most powerful is what a precedent that the community of Flint has set for the entire country and even the world for how powerful it can be when people do organize together and make and bring this up. I mean, we wouldn't even be talking about it mm-hmm. were it not for folks on the ground who were who, despite being dismissed and belittled and disenfranchised in so many ways, like nonetheless kept showing up and in the most like inventive and ultimately effective ways, you know, were able to get this taken seriously despite all odds. It's really incredible. Mm-hmm. And they are a model. I still get Google News alerts, you know, like folks in other communities all around the country that where Flint is a sort of touchstone or totem, you know, for discussing the issues in their own communities. I think it'll be years before we see the full consequences of this, but I think how it has shaken people both within Michigan and beyond is something very significant and can potentially inspire much better choices going forward. And, you know, choices where where all are involved, you know, both those with political power, those with, you know, private businesses and community residents who have a kind of wisdom and talent that deserves acknowledgement.
Great. I agree with you. And I think I'll end it on that note. So I really, really appreciate you coming in to do this. Again, for those of you that haven't had a chance to read it, the book is called The Poison City by Anna Clark. And we were talking before we started recording here, and I said, you know, I don't want to say I enjoyed a book like this, but it is incredibly compelling. So if you haven't had a chance to read it, I would certainly encourage you to do so. And I think there's a lot of takeaways we can all learn from. So thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
This has been a production of the Michigan Municipal League. For more information on our programs and services, please visit www.mml.org and join us for the next episode of We Love Where You Live.